Hello and welcome to AMSSM Sports Medcast. As we approach the 2024 AMSSM annual meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, we continue our mini journal club series highlighting each of the top articles in sports and exercise medicine from 2022 as selected from last spring's annual meeting in Phoenix. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Schroeder, Sports and Exercise Medicine at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I am joined today by Dr. Scott Paradise, a member of the Top Articles Subcommittee, which is part of the AMSSM Education Committee. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Paradise is a sports and exercise medicine physician in the United States Navy and currently serving as a regimental physician for the 2nd Marine Regiment at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He graduated from Penn State University College of Medicine and completed his family medicine residency at AT Augusta Military Medical Center at Fort Belvoir, followed by a fellowship at the Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton in sports and exercise medicine. He currently holds a faculty appointment as assistant professor of family medicine at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, and additionally serves as clinical faculty at the Naval Hospital Camp Lejeune Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. Scott, welcome back for our last episode with you. We made it to the top article in sports and exercise medicine from all of 2022 publications. I am super excited to really hash this last article out with you. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jeremy. Happy to be back and continue our ongoing discussion of the best articles of 2022.
All right, so our numero uno article is coming from the July 2022 issue of the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine by authors Gazendum et al., entitled The Comparative Efficacy of Non-Operative Treatments for Greater Trochanteric Pain Syndrome. This is a systematic review and network meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. Again, I am super stoked to delve into this with you. Scott, can you set the stage for this study?
Yeah, absolutely. Greater trochanteric pain syndrome, maybe not the sexiest of conditions to see in your clinic, but a pretty common condition, right, is affecting as many as 10 to 25% of the population. And for a lot of those people, pretty disabling, right? You know, it's on par in how it disables patients with hip arthritis and back pain at times. And so one that we really need to reevaluate frequently, are we doing the best for our patients and what are the best treatments and what should we leverage early on?
Absolutely. And trochanteric pain syndrome really incorporates a cornucopia of different etiologies. And sometimes our treatment approaches are going to be different based on that etiology. So in this systematic review, was there any discussion at the outset of differentiating different diagnoses within trochanteric pain syndrome, or was this mostly just all grouped together? It's a good question to ask, but I didn't see a clear...
You know, a really good question. The way Gazendum et al. Describe greater trochanteric pain syndrome, they do it pretty broadly. It's this lateral hip pain and tenderness of the lateral hip. And that highlights kind of a difficulty in analyzing this condition in the literature, right? We know that lateral hip pain is not a monolithic entity. It can be complicated by, is it a frank inflammation of the bursa itself? Is it a tendinopathy? Is it an inflammatory tenosynovitis? Is there hydroxyapatite deposition? Are there large differences in mechanics across patients? Is there back pain component, right? All these different variables that layer into the complex nature of greater trochanteric pain syndrome are often lost in the trials of greater trochanteric pain syndrome, where they may not use like a gold standard of like MRI or experienced ultrasound to really delve in on what specific condition are we treating. And part of that is unfortunate because it increased our likelihood of like a type 2 error. If you think of how likely is our study to come up with a signal that is truly positive and not a false negative. But it also kind of mirrors a lot of musculoskeletal medicine's day-to-day practice. And a lot of clinics in primary care or, you know, other musculoskeletal medicine clinics where they do these injections, it really is lateral hip pain with lateral hip tenderness is what people look for. And while we may not be getting the most detailed analysis if we kind of lump every lateral hip pain causing condition into the overarching umbrella of greater trochanteric pain syndrome. In some cases, you could argue that that's okay, because when a patient walks into a busy primary care or even musculoskeletal medicine clinic using that lateral hip pain, lateral hip tenderness, very common condition to stage our initial treatments. And so this is a real world study in that sense, that it is using the very common or the most common diagnostic methods to group this condition.
Awesome. No, I appreciate that. That's a very fair point that you make. Now, we do see in this study that there are specific non-operative treatments and strategies for trochanteric pain syndrome that were analyzed in this particular systematic review. What were those treatments?
So the different comparators in the study were corticosteroid injection. That was done blind and guided, dry needling, shockwave therapy, hyaluronic acid, platelet-rich plasma, no treatment, placebo, and structured exercise.
All right. And now in this systematic review, how many RCTs were included? How many total patients? And what was the main outcome that they were looking for?
So again, this was a systematic review and network meta-analysis. So again, they're taking multiple treatment interventions across studies and making indirect comparisons to gauge those treatment interventions relative to one another. So one trial, again, may take steroid and placebo, and another trial may take PRP and placebo, and they're kind of making that indirect comparison between the steroid and PRP in that example. They did this across 13 randomized trials. It had to be a randomized controlled trial to be included, for a total N just north of 1,000 patients at 1,034 patients.
That's a great N number for this particular condition. So as they broke it down, what did Gazendon and his team discover in their review?
They looked at each of these RCTs, each of these comparisons, and they evaluated pain and function at early and long term. So early being 1 to 3 months and long term being 6 to 12 months. They found that PRP and shockwave provided superior pain relief at 1 to 3 months, and structured exercise programs provided superior functional improvement at 1 to 3 months, so that early term. They did find that no modality was superior to placebo at the 6 to 12 month mark, unfortunately.
And how did those treatments compare with just regular structured exercise when we're looking at these other treatments versus physical therapy and anything else?
The structured exercise program did have the largest or the highest likelihood of superiority for function by Sucre. Sucre, again, being that surface under the cumulative ranking curve that we use to kind of rank our treatments by likelihood of superiority over placebo.
Perfect. So now, after looking at all this data from a myriad of non-operative treatments for our lateral hip pain, trochanteric pain syndrome, what are your key takeaways from this systematic review?
This study gives us some good data on the best treatments for pain and function in that short-term period, 1 to 3 months. It doesn't help us as much in the long-term. It sort of guides more research in that sense, that we still don't have a great answer for like the long-term treatment that's going to alter the long-term natural history of the condition. But I just want to go back to kind of their results here, kind of bring us to a unique point of network meta-analysis. When we do a network meta-analysis, again, we're comparing those indirect treatments, and we're really relying on a principle called transitivity. And transitivity is generally, I can take any study that is included in this meta-analysis, I can take everything out of the meta-analysis, or I can take everything out of that study with the exception of the treatment arm, and I can plug and play whatever treatment I want to in that study, and it'll be basically the same for any study that I'll do. If that works, then we call that study or that network meta-analysis, we call that a coherent network meta-analysis. Basically, it's all those studies are transitive and they don't affect the heterogeneity or the conclusions of that study. When there are lots of variables in the network meta-analysis, you know, whether that be in one study, you know, there are no smokers, and in another study, there are 80% smoke cigarettes, or one study, they had a higher percentage of obesity than another study. Any sort of variable that can affect the outcome of the results of that intervention, if that is heterogeneous across all the studies, then we lose confidence in the network meta-analysis. As a reader, I am looking at that meta-analysis. I'm trying to figure out, have they really addressed all those possible variables, and do they have an explanation for all of them? Unfortunately, this study didn't really do that to the extent that I would want it. And that kind of leaves the reader having to kind of dig through all the data and almost repeat the study themselves, basically re-perform the systematic review to try and figure out if there is a lot of heterogeneity in these variables or effect modifiers. I'll tell you right away that, you know, a structured exercise program is a difficult entity to capture in an interview. If you want to anger a physical therapist, tell them, this trial says that structured exercise is inferior or superior to, you know, this other treatment, because they're so variable in what that means. Similarly, when you're comparing an injection with a non-injection therapy, there's just going to be variables that you can't control for, and it's unclear how much that's going to affect our network meta-analysis. You really need to have solid protocols with good methodologies across these indirect comparisons to do that. And unfortunately for us, the authors largely kind of avoided that discussion. Nonetheless, though, this study does provide that extra bit of evidence that PRP, shockwave, and exercise, at least as evaluated, help in that short term. But again, the long term, a little unclear. Bottom line is, we really just need more comparative studies on, you know, what the long term efficacy of these various treatments are.
Outstanding. I think that's a great way to frame this overall, including some of the weaknesses or limitations from the study, but also looking at some of the great clinical questions that it answered. Now, in summary, Scott, out of the 375 articles that your subcommittee reviewed for all of the 2022 publications, what made this particular article the number one article out of all the other ones that you reviewed?
I think when the group members kind of chose the study, I think they're all kind of looking for that answer for this condition of, what is the best study that I can do to help my patients in the long term? You know, while we really don't have a firm answer to that, it really sheds some light on where we are in the literature and where we need to go. And so PRP, shockwave, exercise, great treatments early on. We still need the more studies to answer what happens in the long term. And I think that's, again, the biggest takeaway for this, and the thing that I think excites me as an avid interpreter and reader of the literature, is that a more exciting thing is to come, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Scott, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to kind of lead us throughout this study, along with all of our top five as we've gone through. I am super excited to go to the annual meeting this year and hear the top articles that you and your team have selected for all the 2023 publications coming through. Any chance we can get any spoilers?
No spoilers, but got a lot of hard work that the group put into it this year. I think you'll be really happy and excited by some of the PICO questions asked for some of these amazing researchers whose hard work we've included. Excited as I am to really dig into their methods and figure out more about their research. So looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks again, Scott.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate you for having me on.
I'd like to thank Dr. Scott Paradise from the AMSSM Top Articles Committee. Links to these articles can be found in our podcast show notes. I'd also like to thank you, the listener. I hope you have found this time valuable. And if so, please, please, please share this podcast with colleagues and help promote the visibility of the podcast by liking, subscribing, and leaving quality 5-star reviews on your preferred listening platform. We hope you'll join us for the 2024 AMSSM Annual Meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, April 12th through the 17th. Please join us again soon for the next edition of the AMSSM Sports Medcast. The views expressed are ours alone and do not represent the official policy or position of the AMSSM, the Defense Health Agency, the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.